Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Jabir Pope's life took a profoundly dark turn on a May night in 1984. What is undisputed, Pope and a partner went to the Dorchester home of two brothers to buy drugs. After that, it gets cloudy. But at the end of the night, one of the brothers was dead, killed by a shotgun blast. Pope was not accused of pulling the trigger. But he and his partner were convicted of participating in an armed robbery, something Pope has denied. Pope asserts no robbery happened, and at trial, his defense claimed a third man, one who died a few months after the night in question, pulled the trigger well out of Pope's sight. Now, because Pope received an armed robbery conviction and someone died, he was also automatically convicted of felony murder. That was common law in Massachusetts at the time. If you committed certain kinds of felonies and someone died, it was murder. And that's automatically life in prison without parole. In 2017, the state Supreme Judicial Court threw that rule out, but they didn't throw it out for past cases. So no change for Pope. He's out now because this past December, the High Court agreed to rehear his case. His lawyer argued in front of the Supreme Judicial Court in March. They are awaiting a decision. Now, the Boston Globe Spotlight team found Jabir Pope's case, and we will talk with them a little later in the show. But first, Pope and his attorney, Jeff Harris, came to our studios yesterday, and Pope began by telling us about his greatest joy coming out of prison.
That's easy. My greatest joy is spending time with my loved ones, particularly my daughter. When I went to prison, her mother was only 4 months along with her, so I've been in prison her entire life. And I was always concerned, even though I tried to be a father from prison the best that I could, I was always concerned about whether or not our relationship would be awkward and kind of out of step because of the distance. Between us, the fact that I've been in prison her entire life, but we just clicked, and it's been wonderful with her. She's my greatest joy.
Walk me through those first few moments when you saw each other for the first time outside the walls.
Well, the first time, the preview to that is that they were in court when the judge made the decision to release me. When I was released, my attorney, Jeff, picked me up, and we made our rounds to various places. I stopped to pray at the mosque. We stopped at Dunkin' Donuts. I got fed and so forth. And then when I finally got home, she was there waiting for me with my grandson, who I had only met once, and he was 10 years old at the time. We embraced, and we just clicked. And she had said to me, well, I had called her when I got back to the institution before my release, and she said, Daddy, this is going to be our first Christmas together. What do you want? I got to do something for you. What do you want? And I said, you want to do something for your father? Take me out and buy me a suit. She said, you got it. And so when I got home that evening, we hung out. We ate together, and the next day we went on a little shopping spree, and we just acted like a couple of kids.
All right, so what about the most challenging things since you've been out?
The most challenging things for me is acclimating myself to the electronics, to learning how to use the phone, the laptop, and like that. In prison, we're on dinosaur status. We don't, having a cell phone in prison is a crime. It's considered an escape tool. And so we don't know how to use it. When I walked out of prison and I saw Jeff's, I said, I want one of those. And we went to the Apple store and got it.
You got one.
I'm still learning how to use it.
There's a moment, the Boston Globe did a feature video, and there's a moment in the video where you and your daughter are in their grocery store, and she's helping you shop, and she's teaching you how to electronic pay at checkout for the first time. And you're even asking her, where's the enter key? And I think we forget how much has changed even in the last 10 or 15 years. Right. I mean, I barely remember paying cash for groceries. The world must have just changed tremendously.
Well, part of that is because I have issues with my sight. I'm losing my sight slowly but surely. And so she was aiding me in navigating my way through that as well. But yeah, overall, it's still a challenge.
So, Jabir, I think we have to go back to the night that night in 1984. You've said publicly that you were there for a drug transaction, but also that you did not participate in an armed robbery and that the man accompanying you acted alone. Bear with me while I explain this for listeners.
Correction there.
Please do.
The man that was with me acted alone? That's not true.
Please clarify.
Neither my co-defendant nor I was involved in any crime other than the fact that we came there for a drug transaction.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's what I meant to say. So that the third party, the person who pulled the trigger, acted independently, separately from you.
That's correct.
Yeah, sorry. That's what I was trying to say. I'm glad you clarified. So I want to explain this for listeners. You were convicted of participating in a robbery. And because someone died during that robbery, you were essentially automatically convicted of felony murder, which carries a life sentence without parole. Is that night something that you think about often? Is it vivid for you, or does it feel like something from another lifetime?
No, it's very, very vivid in my mind. It'll probably be present in my mind for now on. Because when I was arrested afterward, you know, it's like the whole sky had fell on me, and it was like trying to navigate my way through that. It's like what just happened here. It was necessary to relive that in an effort to try to defend myself. And as the case unfolded and over the years appeals took place and like that, I had to continue to relive that night.
You have said that you have served time as a guilty person and as an innocent person, and that serving in those two different situations are wildly different experiences. And you've expressed the kind of the lasting burning anger over serving time as an innocent man. Is there any amount of time that you do think you should have served from that night? And do you think overall that the victim's family got justice?
Well, first of all, I was there for a drug deal, and I was never charged with that. What I went to prison for, I had absolutely nothing to do with. I will say for the record that the real crime that was committed that night, the only people that was robbed that night, in fact, everybody in that house was robbed that night except the individual that said he was robbed. His brother, God bless him, you know, Wing, was robbed of his life, and my co-defendant and I was robbed of our freedom. That was the only robberies that took place that night. He probably, with the assistance of the police and probably other members of the system, was allowed to delay his crimes at the feet of his dead brother and to bear false witness against me and my co-defendant. That's his burden to carry, and that's something for him to work out with his family. I'm not going to sit in judgment on that because I don't want anybody sitting in judgment on me.
So, Jeff, let me bring you into the conversation now. How did you and Jabir connect, and when did you have a sense that there was a real case to appeal here?
Well, this goes back to, I think, to 2016. I had been contacted by him, and he asked me to look into the case. And I went to the public defender's office, and I said, I'd like to do what's called a screening. And they said, okay, you take some time to try to figure out whether or not there's a case here. You read the transcripts. At the time, the DA's office in Suffolk County was good enough to allow me to come in and look at the trial file that the prosecutor had. That's very much to their credit. And I went in there and I looked at the file, and immediately I noticed that there were conflicting statements that had been made by the witness that night that hadn't been turned over to the defense. And I knew at that point that certainly there was a very good case for Mr. Pope, that he had had an unfair trial. I also knew that he had been fighting this issue, felony murder, right from the beginning. He had even pre-trial in 1984, he had recognized that this was an issue. Even when his lawyer told him look, Mr. Pope, this is not something that we can argue. He persevered and said, no, I think we should. And so argued that pre-trial, argued it at trial, argued it after trial, argued it even in his direct appeal. And he said, if the law should ever change, if the SJC ever decide changes its mind on whether or not this is a legitimate theory of conviction for first-degree murder, I want the benefit of that.
The SJC and being the Supreme Judicial Court.
Yeah,
for the state.
I'm sorry. Yeah, the Supreme Court of Massachusetts. And lo and behold, you know, 30 years later, or I guess it was 26 years later or so, they did change their mind. So, yeah, I knew that there were several issues that could be really beneficial to Mr. Pope. And so I took the case and we put together a motion for new trial. It took a couple of years, actually. And the case was brought to the Supreme Judicial Court by Justice Kafker, who decided that there were sufficient issues presented that the case should be argued in front of the Supreme Court in Massachusetts. And we did argue that on March 9th. And so right now where the case stands is that the SJC has it under advisement, and they will decide at some point, we don't really know, could be this afternoon, it could be in July, it could be next year.
What did you ask for? In a layperson's terms, what do you want the court to do?
So the court has to recognize that because Mr. Pope didn't have these conflicting statements from the witness from the night of the
didn't have access to
didn't them. Have yeah, you know, but they weren't disclosed. So he wasn't able to argue that this guy's lying, which he was. And so we want a new trial.
Because it's a constitutional violation.
Because it's exactly. He has a due process right to all of the exculpatory evidence, and that counts as exculpatory evidence.
And that's what we're waiting to find out from the Supreme Judicial Court.
So that and the question of whether or not they will change the rule around felony murder. So what happened in 2017 is that they did change the rule in the way that Mr. Pope had asked. That shouldn't be a legitimate way to prove someone guilty of first-degree murder, as you described earlier. And they did finally agree with him, but they said, well, this is only going forward. It's only prospective. It's not retroactive.
Not retroactive.
And that's what the Globe article from last Sunday was about.
Right.
The people who have been kind of left behind by that.
Were you aware in 2017, Jabir, when the Supreme Judicial Court made the change, and were you aware that you both got what you wanted, but you didn't get it for you?
Yes.
How did that feel?
Well, that came on the heels of a handful of other rulings. Periodically, there were things that occurred. For example, a few years ago, there was an issue of that arose about closed courtroom, and that was a constitutional violation. That gave a lot of people hope. It was an issue in my case as well. I went back to my transcripts when that case came out and realized that was one of my issues as well. The Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts released a few guys and then quickly closed the door behind them and not allowing other people to benefit from that violation as well. So those kind of things occurred over the scope of my incarceration. So when the Brown decision came out, it was just another one of those situations where they said the right thing but didn't do the right thing, for lack of a better phrase.
So the Brown decision is that 2017 decision by the Supreme Judicial Court, which affected cases afterward but not cases before. The dissent in that, Frank Gaziano, who wrote in the dissent, said that overturning the felony murder rule, quote, diminishes the seriousness of violent felonies that result in the deaths of innocent victims, end quote. So that's the pushback to the change that the Supreme Judicial Court made. What do you think about that argument?
Well, I would respectfully suggest that probably in virtually every other aspects of law that people are responsible for their own deeds. You know, everybody's held accountable for what they do. The idea that people are held accountable for the actions of others is just patently unfair. I would liken it to a circumstances that I had in prison one time when they wanted to punish the whole block for the sins of a couple of individuals. And my response to that was that if my behavior is insufficient to protect me, you know, against getting punishment, that's not the message that you want to send me, because then I don't have any incentive to behave. You follow me?
I do.
And so because it's patently unjust, particularly if it was another crime, then people would be held responsible for their own deeds and no one else's.
As I listen to you, I think about living with 40 years of feeling like your life's been taken away in an injustice. What's the mechanism to get through day by day?
The fact that I didn't want to die in prison, the fact that I wanted to get back to my child. I used to have conversations with her periodically. Again, when there would be various changes in the law that would give us hope, I would say to her, even up until this point, that I might have a chance of coming home. And she would say to me, Daddy, you always say that. And it's almost like she lost hope, and that broke my heart. But it also increased the flame in me to continue to fight and fight as hard as I could to get my freedom, because I did not want to perish in prison. I did not want her to live her entire life without sharing a moment with her father.
And Jabir, when I ask you this question, I want to be clear, I don't ask it glibly. I'm not touring someone else's experience. I am sitting with the weight of the thought that you don't know whether you're going back behind those walls or not. How do you manage that?
With my faith, frankly. I just have to believe that that the right thing, that the higher power will intercede and bring about a just result. You know, I'm comforted by the fact that I have an excellent attorney who has done a wonderful job. I would like to think that the Supreme Court that is sitting now would be open-minded in their search and strive for justice as well. But at the same time, I've endured a lot of disappointments over the years, and so I have to prepare myself for yet another if that becomes my reality.
Jabir Pope served nearly four decades in prison for his involvement in a murder he did not commit. He's out while the state Supreme Judicial Court considers his case. We also heard there from Jeff Harris, Pope's attorney and a lecturer at the Boston University School of Law. Now stay with us. When we come back, two Globe Spotlight reporters who investigated the state's felony murder rule and brought Jabir Pope's story forward. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We started today's show with Jabir Pope, a man who has served nearly four decades of a life sentence without parole. Pope was convicted of felony murder despite the fact that he didn't kill anyone.
It also increased the flame in me to continue to fight and fight as hard as I could to get my freedom, because I did not want to perish in prison.
The Boston Globe Spotlight team found Pope as part of an investigation that surfaced at least 23 men, all but one, Black or Hispanic, still serving life in prison without parole because someone died during a felony they were convicted of committing, even though they didn't kill the victim. The Supreme Judicial Court overturned that common law rule in 2017, but not for them. Joining us now, Megan Irons and Mark Arsenault, both of the Spotlight team. Megan, Mark, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Megan, how did you get started on this story?
Well, I joined the Spotlight team late last year, and Mark had already started work with Jabir and his lawyer looking into this really interesting issue. And I was just happy to be part of this the Spotlight team project, because I think what it opened up for me was a little known window into the criminal justice world of people who are still behind bars, accused of you know, serious crimes, and for whom there still remains little justice. And so this project was an eye-opening experience for me in learning about the murder laws in our state and around the country, and in learning of people who are behind bars, unable to get any sort of remedy or a path out.
So, Mark, you can't just Google give me the list of people who are still incarcerated pre-2017, right? So this took work. What did you have to do to figure out who was affected by this? And did you expect the number to be 24 at least?
I don't think we had much expectations on how many people that we were, there would be. I think we needed to try to put some kind of number on it. And look, we're definitely not claiming that we think our numbers are complete. I think we did the best we could. This had to be done by hand. Essentially, people who end up serving life without parole sentences, their cases all ultimately end up at the Supreme Judicial Court for an appeal. It's called the 33E appeal. And those records are all online and available. So we did a search through those for people serving first degree sentences on felony murder terms. Now, again, you can be convicted of felony murder and be the only person involved and be the person accused of actually committing the violence. We weren't interested in those people. We were interested in people who were convicted of first degree murder despite having inflicted no violence on the person who was killed in the crime. And so we had to read these cases. We had to read the summaries of these cases. And what made it a little bit easier is, for the most part, the court summarizes the facts of the crime in these decisions. Where that was lacking, we went back and looked at contemporary news coverage of those crimes, the Globe's coverage from other newspapers, and other court documents we were able to get to come up with our list.
And Megan, what was the most, I don't know what the word is, I don't want to over-editorialize here, shocking, stunning, surprising of those cases to you?
Oh, there were so many just eye-opening moments in those cases. But I think when we look at felony murder specifically about the group of people that Mark just described that we were focused on, you see the injustice, right? You see people who have been sent to prison to spend the rest of their lives in prison with no possibility of parole, people who were in a car waiting, people who were not even in the same room as the person who actually pulled the trigger, people who weren't even in the same building. In Timothy Brown's case, he wasn't even there. To see that somebody in those particular circumstances, because we are, after all, talking about first degree murder cases, right? And we're talking about people who might have had a peripheral role in those felonies. But when you look at those cases and you see that somebody like Timothy Brown, who wasn't even close to the murder scene, yet was given a life sentence. Now, although his sentence, he was convicted of second-degree murder.
Was he the one that lent the two sweatshirts and the handgun?
Exactly. He loaned the actual killers two hoodies and his handgun, and he was the case law from 2017. It was the justices did lower his conviction to second degree murder, but there were so many people like him who weren't even there and have been given life without the possibility of parole. One of the other things I will say, Tiziana, is what we found out that I thought was pretty striking also was that the killers in some cases were allowed to given plea deals, and in which they took the plea deals, were able to plead and get out of prison, while the person who did not kill didn't take the plea deal and thought they would have better chances with a jury. And oftentimes they didn't. They ended up getting convicted and sentenced automatically to life without the possibility of parole.
So as the two of you have reported this story, there's been response, even some DAs in a follow-up story supporting a legislative solution. So, Mark, talk a little bit more about the aftermath of your reporting and what's happening now.
Yeah, I think that the district attorneys sort of set the bar on what they think would be a equitable solution, which would be a bill by the legislature. When California reformed its felony murder rules in 2018, something that Megan reported and knows a lot more about than I do. They did make it retroactive for people on the periphery of crimes, and some people have petitioned for a sentencing review and have had their sentences reduced or even have them freed. So that probably seems to be the most likely way to go. I mean, of course, the court, the Supreme Judicial Court, is they are the ultimate authority of the common law in this state, and they could do whatever they wanted. They could use the Beers case to change the common law again if they want, but they just did that 5 years ago. So I guess I'm not really expecting that. The governor could commute all these sentences, but that's a really long and difficult and arduous process for good reason. So it looks like the legislature might be the most reasonable way to go.
So, Megan, we've got about 30 seconds left, so in maybe two sentences. Is there another thread here that you want to follow now that you can tell us about?
I wouldn't be able to tell you about it, Tiziana.
I wondered. But are there threads you're following? Let's do it that way.
We've been getting a lot of really interesting responses, as Mark said, not just from the DAs, but from other cases as well that are interesting. And we'll be taking a closer look at that going forward.
All right. Megan Irons. Oh, sorry. Did you have one more thing to say?
No, that was it.
Okay. Megan Irons, Mark Arsenault, reporters for the Boston Globe Spotlight team who reported on this story of felony murder and people still serving incarceration. Thanks to both of you for sharing more of the story with us today.
Right on. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us on.
Great to have you. All right. Stay with us, folks. Coming up, the Boston Marathon. It is right around the corner, now back in its normal spot on the calendar. But there's still a difference in this year's race, and we'll tell you about it with Alex Ashlock after the break. I'm Tiziana Deering, and you are listening to Radio Boston. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Boston Marathon is actually happening in person when it is supposed to this year. And you might recall that hasn't been the case for a couple of years. Still, there is something really unusual going on. Athletes who live in Russia and Belarus can't run. That puts the marathon in the company of a host of other international competitions banning athletes from Russia and Belarus. Joining us now to explain and to help us look ahead to Marathon Day, our longtime marathon companion, WBUR's marathon reporter and former Here and Now producer, Alex Ashlock. Alex, welcome back.
Thanks for asking me.
Oh, it's so great to have you here.
Yeah, great to be in the studio.
I know, right? All right, so clarify what this actually means, Alex.
Well, I think what people are hearing is that all of these runners are barred from the marathon. That's the word you keep hearing. And that's not entirely accurate. It's a little more nuanced than that. It only applies to runners who actually live in Russia or Belarus and would be coming to Boston for the race this month from those countries. And the BAA says that's about 60 people who were entered in this year's marathon. If you're from Russia or Belarus, but you live and train in another country and you can show that you're doing that, you are going to be able to run. And the BAA told me this afternoon they're working with runners who fit that description to make sure their residency is accurate, things like that, to make sure they'll be able to run coming up in a couple of days, a few days.
I know, it's so
it's coming
up.
It's close.
All right, so we know this has been happening in other sports.
Right.
And you've got tennis, judo, badminton, chess. But how about running? Is there precedent for this? And has the marathon or other similar events banned athletes before?
Yeah, you know, the Boston Marathon, it's very unusual for the Boston Marathon to do this, but not unprecedented. The BAA told me earlier today that runners from Japan were not allowed in the race during World War II, but they were eventually welcomed back, of course. Japanese athletes have been winners here in the past. But now with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the marathon here is following decisions that you mentioned before with other sports and also taking a cue from World Athletics, which controls the big marathons in the world. They've banned athletes World Athletics has banned athletes who live in Russia and Belarus. They did this from last month's World Indoor Track and Field Championships in Belgrade. They've also banned runners from Belarus and Russia who live in those countries from the World Outdoor Championships in Eugene, Oregon this summer. And that's coming up as well. It's worth noting, Tiziana, that the Russian track and field teams have been banned from international competitions, including the Olympics, for a few years now because of doping. They did perform as individuals in February's Winter Games. But you'll also remember that Russian President Vladimir Putin was in Beijing for the opening ceremonies those Winter Olympics. So
that's right.
That's also something that's worth looking at.
All right, so tell us about reactions from other athletes.
You know, athletes like to compete. They don't always like to get involved in politics, but you know, we remember the NBA and WNBA players and Black Lives Matter and the social justice issues after the killing of George Floyd, those athletes speaking out. I reached out to some of the runners I know to talk to them to see what they had to say about this. I did hear back from Jared Ward. He's running the Olympic Marathon. He'll be here for the Boston Marathon on April 18th. And I'm just going to quote from his statement here. He said, "One nice thing about running is that it takes the focus off what makes us different and emphasizes what makes us the same. I'm not a politician or an economist, but I hope we can continue to remember that there are people struggling on both sides of the Russian border." So that was his comment today.
So obviously we don't know where we're going to be 6 months from now, but what about other marathons coming up?
Sure. Well, Boston is in April. Chicago and London are coming up in October. Those two marathons are going to do the same thing that the Boston Marathon is doing. They're barring runners who live in Russia and Belarus from their races. They're following those restrictions put in place by World Athletics. The organization that puts on the London Marathon told me today they're not doing business with any Russian or companies from Russia or Belarus or individuals. And they're also allocating entries to enable fundraising for relief work for what's going on in Ukraine. And both Chicago and London, like Boston, are allowing runners who are from those countries but who don't live in Russia or Belarus to compete.
Okay, so the marathon is back in its spot on the calendar.
Finally.
But it only ran 6 months ago.
Right.
In 2021, it was in October. Some runners are saying 6 months isn't enough, and there have been some repercussions from that. Ethiopia's Kanisye Bekele, if I pronounced that correctly, second fastest marathoner in history. Sarah Hall, the third fastest American female marathoner in history, have both withdrawn. Tell us a little bit about how that proximity to the last race is affecting things.
Sure. It's really a shame that these two runners have withdrawn from the race. Bekele would have been running here for the first time. He's one of the greatest marathon runners, long-distance runners in the history of the world. So we lose some luster with him not here. We don't really know why he's not coming to Boston because, as I said, he's never run here before. So he hasn't. It's not a question of Boston in 2021 being too soon to Boston in 2022. The last marathon he ran was in 2021. It was in New York. He finished sixth. He's a four-time world record holder, but he's going to be 41 years old in June.
Oh.
So maybe we're seeing the end of his career. I don't want to say that for sure, but it could be happening. Sarah Hall is pulling out because she's injured, and some of that might be because she's just been so busy. She ran a great half marathon in January. In March, you know, not even a month or so ago, she finished eighth in the Tokyo Marathon. So her pulling out is not as unusual. She's skipping Boston so she can focus on the World Outdoor Championships, the marathon there in Oregon in July. We are going to see some great runners here, though. It's always a world-class field. I'm really looking forward to Molly Seidel. She's lived here in Boston and trained in Boston. She finished third in the Olympics in Tokyo, in Beijing. So, you know, there are going to be plenty of great runners here.
Excellent. All right. So in these last 30 seconds or so, you have been covering this marathon for 25 years.
Yes, this one is number 25.
There you go. All right. So give us just a little bit of a sneak preview about the next few days.
You know, I'm just looking forward to it being back in April on Patriots Day. We talked on Marathon Day in October. It was really great to see the marathon back. But, it felt, not that it didn't feel right, but it just felt out of place.
Different.
Yeah. So it's just going to be great to see the marathon back on Patriots Day. It's springtime. People are coming out from the winter. It's a holiday. You know, people come out to watch the race. Hopefully the crowds will be out. Hopefully it'll be a nice day. If you're out and about in the city now, you can sort of feel, I think, at least I can. Maybe that's just me, but I can feel the city coming back. And, you know, the banners are up for the marathon. You can see them on Commonwealth Avenue. So I'm just looking forward to Patriots Day.
Well, Alex, it is great to have you here. Alex Ashlock, WBUR Marathon Reporter, thanks.
You're welcome.
All right, folks, we close today with a programming note. A reminder, we are stepping back on Fridays for a few weeks so we can work on a special project. So we won't be with you tomorrow, but you can enjoy a bonus episode of Fresh Air. And then Come back and join us again on Monday. We'll be here, and we want you to come listen for more Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks so much.